JT live in Vegas.
From the Las Vegas Strip right to our studios on Flamingo.
Woohoo!
I'm here because I got to put two kids through college.
LeBron.
We ask everybody to participate, from Uber drivers to taxi drivers to bartenders. I mean, I never slow down. I stand up in the studio. I'm excited to be on the radio. I like energetic callers who have opinions. Sound off like you got a pair.
Woohoo!
Oh, I'm cranky Yankee. How do the Yankees lose a game like this? Are you kidding me?
And now, live from Las Vegas, here's JT the Brick.
Thanks for joining us today, JT, with you. Tomorrow and Friday, we'll be at NBA Summer League. Really excited about that. World Cup fever, I believe, has come to an end after England's loss. And I got a lot to get to today. Big show. If you want to start dialing, 876-1340 is our number. Again, you know, I'm the call crazy guy. I like to hear from you. I know you're listening, but I like to know for sure if you call in on anything we're talking about. Here in the monologue, 876-1340 is the number. And as always, we're brought to you by Golden Entertainment. They own PT's, the Stratosphere, Arizona Charlie, Sierra Gold, Sean Patrick, the home of the best happy hour in Vegas, where I was today to watch England at the SG. Was there for the second half, right there at the 215 and Flamingo. I want to lead with World Cup, but I quickly want to get into a couple things and tell you what we have lined up first. We're going to talk to Larry Pepe, UFC insider, coming up here in about 10, 15 minutes on Daniel Cormier coming up and winning the heavyweight title, which happened this past weekend. I want to talk about the current state of UFC, especially since the sale. Where is McGregor? Where is the sport going from here? And the legacy of Daniel Cormier coming off that win, which was a monster legacy win, which is great. And then a great friend of mine, a gentleman by the name of Alan Eisenstock, a great author. He's written 14, 15 books, including my book he co-authored, The Handoff. He wrote the newest sensation, Hang Time, My Life in Basketball, The Life of Elgin Baylor, one of the great Lakers of all time, one of the great NBA players of all time. It is a really good deep dive into one of the more important figures in sports history, let alone NBA history. He wrote the book on that. If you're a Laker fan, a lot of people are comparing LeBron James and his style of play to Elgin Baylor. We'll make that comparison a little bit later in the show at the bottom of the hour. The World Cup final is set now, coming into what will be a World Cup final, which I think is going to be a bit of a letdown. We lost the golden opportunity to have England play France. That's a natural rivalry. I think it would have been a monster rating for Big Fox. And no disrespect to Croatia, I think the better team won. It would have been nice for England to get in because I think more England fans would have been vocal. More fans around the globe would have connected with England instead of Croatia. But Croatia was the better team. England took the lead early in this game on another set piece. I thought that would be enough to win it.
Kieran Trippier has not scored for his country in his career. And that one is in! First career goal for Kieran Trippier! Puts England in front of the semifinal!
And that was right out of the gate. And then there was an unbelievable goal by Croatia. They score again. It goes into the extra time, and Croatia advances to take on France in the World Cup final. Here's how I'd like to engage you today, because Vegas is a soccer town, right? Where I live, wherever you drive by, this kid's playing soccer, right? Juice boxes, high school, college. UNLV's got a really good program, women's and men. Here's the point that I need to engage you on today and talk to you on. How come Croatia, a tiny country, with four, and you look at how many people that they have, you know, I think it's four, I tweeted it out, 4.1 million people are in the World Cup final, but the United States of America, with 326 million, can't even qualify. Anybody? Bueller? How come a country like Croatia can not only qualify, and you can talk about qualifications and the region of the world that they play in, and they got a couple of really good players who are global players who play internationally, but why is it so difficult for us? Now, here's the excuse. The excuse, JT, here's the excuse. Our best players are playing other sports. No, that's lame. That was 30 years ago. That's done. We have great athletes who play. Our systems are not in place here in the United States of America to develop the Christian Pulitzers of the world here in the United States. We have to send our only good young players overseas to get training. Did we run out of money or something? I mean, we got more money than anybody in this country, right? How come we don't have like 17 youth academies? One in the Pacific Northwest, one in LA, one in the state of Arizona, one in the South, three or four in New York. We're developing young superstars to play soccer. And then when these kids are good, when we identify that these kids are unbelievable at the age of 14, 15, 16, we immediately, instead of send them to Europe to get the proper training so they can play in the Bundesliga or they can be, you know, playing for Real Madrid's junior team, why can't we develop them here, get them to stay here, feed them, give them free lodging, free training, and then keep them here in the United States of America? And I'll answer why. Because we are the bleeping minor leagues of the biggest sport in the world. We are so minor league that our minor leagues, which is our professional league, the MLS, is like the 17th lowest level of soccer in the world. So we think our pros are good. We get David Beckham, Wayne Rooney, Thierry Henry. These guys come at the end of their career for one more paycheck to play here, and it's picking up steam. It's 2018, and today I watch Croatia, a small, tiny country, advance to the World Cup final as we did not qualify. If that's not an embarrassment to you, then you don't get embarrassed much by sports. I make a living in sports. It's my job to address this with you, and I'd love to hear your opinion. 876-1340. Maybe there's a soccer mom driving around, wants to get through. Maybe there's a soccer coach out there. Maybe there's a former soccer player who has an opinion on this, because I'm frustrated with it. Because the United States of America should be able to field the team that could go out there and beat bleeping Croatia. Okay, look, if we don't beat Argentina, if we don't beat some of the powers, I get it. But we should be in every World Cup. We should be advancing in the World Cup. Now, a couple of these players I was describing today from Belgium and a couple of the players that I saw from France, Pogba, the midfielder, they look like they're NFL safeties. So we have NFL safeties who could be playing soccer, but they're playing corner in the NFL. Or we have boxers, like a guy who looks like Adrian Broner, or a big middleweight fighter. They decide to go boxing, which is much more difficult and painful than playing soccer, in the hopes of making money like Floyd Mayweather. The problem is we haven't convinced the kids in this country, the young boys, because the girl's great. By the way, I apologize if I offended anyone who has a daughter. The women are phenomenal. The women are great. They represent this country well. We got guys like Landon Donovan and Clint Dempsey. Would you pick them in a barroom brawl? Would be those be the two guys you say, hey, I got my back up against the wall. Let's do this. So today, when I talk about soccer, I'm not going to get a phone call on Croatia. So the way that I'm going to do this is I'm going to point fingers at us, the United States of America, and ask you directly why we can't compete at the global level. And please don't give me an excuse like it's coming, JT. It's coming in 4 years. It'll be here in 8 years. It should have happened 30 years ago. And the way to do it is money. We solve all our problems in this country with cold, hard cash, don't we? We run global deficits, and we buy our way out of it, and we refi our homes, and we borrow money on our credit cards, and we can't figure out a way to buy a youth soccer team and to convince about 200-300 young boys at the age of 12 that are really good to just stay here. We'll train you, we'll feed you, we'll give you scholarships, we'll pay for you to play here, we'll send you overseas to get training, but you're going to play overseas with the best players, not here with the MLS, and then we're going to bring you home. We're going to bring you home for the World Cup. And we're going to bring you all home, all you great kids who are here that we sent off to the Premier League and we sent off to the Bundesliga and we sent off to La Liga to get the right training. And we're going to bring you back to play for the World Cup. No one has an answer. And today, it just hit me on my couch as I was rooting for England. Croatia wins. They say, at a country with only 4 million people, the second smallest country in population size to ever advance to a World Cup final. And we're the big boys on the block with all the money. We have a tremendous passion for soccer, and we're not able to advance. 876-1340 is the number. We'll get into this a little bit later on tonight. Big guest, Evan Rosenblum from TMZ, is going to join us. I think it's 6:15 on the national show to talk about the update with LeSean McCoy. And what's happening with him is he's lawyered up as his girlfriend or recently ex-girlfriend was beaten in his home in Georgia and outside of Atlanta. And now they're trying to connect the dots, saying that the running back for the Buffalo Bills could have been allegedly involved with this at some level. He's in Miami training and working out for the upcoming NFL season. He completely denies everything, but he did hire one of the high-profile attorneys in Atlanta who also represented Ray Lewis when Ray Lewis got off the double murder trial. So it's a huge black eye for the NFL, but a big update. We'll have that for you in a couple of hours. Daniel Cormier wins the heavyweight title. Incredible performance. What does that mean for UFC going forward? The great MMA insider, Larry Pepe, joins us here on Fox Sports Radio. Larry, great to catch up with you again. How's your summer been?
It's been great, JT. Great to catch up with you as well.
Really appreciate your time. Talk to me first off about the significance of this win over Miocic, because I had dinner with the reigning champion the night before the fight right here locally in town at Giuseppe's, and he was confident, and he had his team around him. They weren't cocky. They were just confident. He looks like a mountain of a man. What was the tactical mistake that gave Cormier the advantage?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First, you know, people forget that Daniel Cormier started his career as a heavyweight. And I've always felt that he was a better heavyweight than light heavyweight. He came into this fight at 246 pounds. That means to make the 205 limit for a light heavy title fight, he's dropping 41 pounds. And you can see he simply doesn't have the power and the strength that we see at heavyweight for Daniel. So I think a lot of people ignored that he was 13-0 as a heavyweight in MMA and had never lost a round and was the Strikeforce Grand Prix champion. So as much as it was marketed and was a light heavyweight versus a heavyweight, technically, yes. But a guy who probably should have been fighting at heavyweight his whole career and only went down to light heavyweight to not be in the same weight division as his training partner and quasi-brother, Cain Velasquez. So to me, it was not an unexpected result where I think Stipe, I don't think he did anything wrong per se. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time when Daniel threw the perfect right hand and floored him. And then it was a wrap. And if you look at Stipe's fight with Alistair Overeem, he doesn't have a rock-solid chin, and Daniel touched it. And when you have heavyweights and they're slinging leather with four-ounce gloves, it only takes one.
Larry Pepe is our guest, MMA insider. And talk about the legacy win. What does this do for Cormier? Because the critics say, well, it's just not top-heavy. There aren't great, great heavyweights, and John Bones Jones can't stay clean to dominate this sport and be the greatest of all time. What does it do for Cormier in the biggest win of his career, arguably?
Oh, I think it does a lot for him from a legacy standpoint. I'm not going to be a prisoner of the moment and say that he's the greatest mixed martial artist of all time. I think he's in the discussion with this win, but it's hard to overcome. I guess it depends on whether you feel Barry Bonds is the greatest home run hitter of all time. If you do, then John Jones is clearly better than Daniel Cormier. They fought twice. Jones dominated him twice. One time he tested hot, the other time he didn't. So it kind of comes down to where you fall on that, but I think what he did with this win, and it's a huge win. Forget about that the heavyweight division isn't that great. It's not. But Stipe Miocic had more heavyweight title defenses consecutively than any fighter in UFC history. So he didn't beat a guy who got lucky once, and then Daniel got lucky once, and you discredit the whole thing. He beat a legit heavyweight champion. He put himself in the conversation with maybe four or five other fighters for greatest of all time. But Jones is always going to be that asterisk when you think of Daniel Cormier and you're trying to make the argument that he's the greatest ever.
MMA insider Larry Pepe's our guest on Fox Sports Radio. Was it a bad look to see Lesnar come in the ring and for him to get called out and come in there and push? It had such a WWE feel to it, and it's not WWE, it's UFC. What was your takeaway from that?
JT, you know why it had a WWE look to it? Because that's exactly what they're becoming. And personally, I hate it. I think it's a bad look. I think, listen, you have a decision to make. if you're the UFC, and clearly they've made the decision, are you a sport first, entertainment second, like other legitimate sports, right? You don't see Roger Goodell select the teams for the Super Bowl that will do the best ratings. You still have to earn your way there. And then it is the promotion or the league's responsibility to take on the market and create interest and make money with those who perform athletically first. Or do you want to be the WWE except when the cage door closes and it's a legit fight? And there is no argument, none, that that is who they have become. And it doesn't just begin with the sale. It actually led up to the sale, because you can go all the way back to when Chael Sonnen talked himself into a title fight with John Jones when Sonnen hadn't won a fight at light heavyweight in like 8 years. And he had no business fighting him, none. But because he had a big mouth and could talk a fight up and promote, he got a title fight with John Jones. And you've seen it as we go forward. You saw it with what they let McGregor do with Mayweather. That's the blueprint now, and you can't blame the fighters for kind of following along, because they're seeing other fighters have success talking themselves into big fights instead of earning themselves into big fights. And the Lesnar fight, in all honesty, is an absolute farce. This guy hasn't won a UFC fight in 8 years. He's fought once in the last 6 years and tested hot, and it was turned to a no contest. And he's fighting for the heavyweight title? That means that you are more WWE than legitimate sport. And for those of us that have been following it a long time and felt like it was on the verge of that real mainstream birth into the upper levels of sport, I think it's a real turnoff. And I clearly am not alone, because all their ratings and pay-per-view numbers have turned to trash when Conor McGregor or the now-retired Ronda Rousey are not fighting.
Larry Pepe is our guest. Larry, give this a listen so we can give our audience of the feel of what happened after the fight.
Let me tell you something. I walked into this building and watched the heavyweight disasters from the beginning. Nagano's a piece of Miocic's a piece of DC, I'm coming for you.
So, Larry, now we know that Brock Lesnar has officially re-entered the UFC's anti-doping program, and USADA confirmed that Lesnar's re-enrollment into the program, that came out on Monday. So, again, it just feels like this is going to be built up again. You're so good on the radio. I'm thrilled we got you booked today, because I got diehard MMA fans listening, and the diehards, just like the diehard Raider fans and the diehard fans of their favorite team and other sports, don't want to see corruption come around it, or the fake sense of, hey, we're going to play down to the lowest common denominator to try to sell the sport for one more big event. What are the diehard MMA fans saying about Lesnar? It seems like most of them understand that this fight's going to happen, because it has to happen.
It's going to happen because they're desperate for money. Lesnar draws, McGregor's sitting at home doing who knows what, and Rousey is retired, and George St. Pierre seems to be Dana White's worst enemy. It's amazing for a guy who sold more pay-per-views over the course of his career. It's like Dana hates the guy, but he is semi-retired. Who knows what he's going to do? He's a big draw. So this is a money grab, and fans know that it's a money grab. And listen, is it going to sell better than if Daniel Cormier fought Curtis Blaydes or Alexander Gustafsson, the probably the most legitimate contenders at heavyweight and light heavyweight? Yes, but that goes back to my earlier comment, JT. You have to make a decision if you're a sport first or you're entertainment first. If you're entertainment first, then you're more WWE than NFL. So stop calling yourself the NFL of MMA and start calling yourself the WWE of MMA, because that's what you've chosen to become. And you have to own that. And hardcore fans are going to look at the Lesnar fight for the farce that it is, and Daniel Cormier will beat the daylights out of him and then ride off into the sunset with a lot of money. And good for him. I don't begrudge him that. But it comes down to, what do you want to be? You know, when you get on the radio, do you want to be a sports guy who's entertaining, Or do you want to scream about stuff that has nothing to do with sports because you think you're an entertainer first? They've made the second decision. And I think for people who really saw the potential of the sport when it was in kind of its golden era and all people talked about was, oh, there's a UFC this week. Who's the pay-per-view this month? That's gone.
Larry Pepe's our guest. Fantastic conversation as we wrap it up. I'm a Dana White fan because living in Vegas and seeing his success and interviewing him over the years, even though I'm a boxing guy more than an MMA guy, I respect the arc of his path to how he built up this incredible brand and his role with it, especially staying on board during the sale. What does Dana have to worry about going forward, considering he's the face of UFC more so than the fighters?
Well, listen, with all due respect, I don't think it would have gone the direction it went if Dana wasn't steering that ship. So, you know, you'd have to ask him what he has to worry about. I think what he has to worry about is declining ratings, is people in droves exiting the UFC. And I think he's got to worry about the fact that he just signed an ESPN deal, which is, in my opinion, a ridiculous deal. Good money for the UFC, but for the fan base, it's a disaster. You're going to put 30 cards on ESPN and the ESPN Plus app. So you can't, starting in 2019, JT, you cannot watch a UFC card from beginning to end without taking money out of your pocket. That's insane. That is not going to expand your base. They're only going to put 10 events on actual television, and those events will only be the main cards, and there is not a commitment that they'll be on ESPN, but one of the ESPN networks. And you know better than I do, college football is king. Mm-hmm. If you think on a Saturday during college football season, the UFC is occupying ESPN proper real estate, you're nuts. So you're going to be on ESPN News or ESPN who the hell knows what. And then all the prelims for all those cards, you have to pay for an app. That, to me, is not how you're going to grow your fan base and bring fans back. I think you're going to dwindle the fan base. And if I were Dana, great. You got a great deal for 5 years. I'd be thinking about an exit strategy for year five, or how the hell am I getting the next partner to ante up for a vapidly declining fan base? Because last time I checked, that's not supposed to be the goal.
Are you concerned for yourself as a journalist that there's going to be room for you as you're this critical, which I think is compelling radio, and I really love having you on, but do you believe that this is going to be something for you in the future where you're not going to be able to have the access as some other journalists in the past have had it taken away? Where are you now covering this sport going forward if you're this critical here in Vegas?
Well, I laugh because I voluntarily gave that access up like 6 years ago. When I felt that things were turning in the wrong direction, in my opinion, when I saw the Chael Sonnens getting title fights that they had no business getting, I made a decision to be completely independent. I do not interview fighters. I do shows like yours. I did Pro MMA Radio for 10 years and 6 years for the military. But my view, JT, has always been this. At the end of the day, I'm not here to kiss anybody's butt. I'm not here for access. I'm not here for any of that. That doesn't make me a tough guy. I'm here to be honest. I'm here to tell you what I see. And I told you great things about Daniel Cormier. That's what I saw. If the UFC was promoting their promotion the way that it used to, you'd be hearing lots of positive things from me. But at the end of the day, as journalists, as broadcasters, we have to live with ourselves. And for me to live with myself, I have to tell the truth as I see it. It may not always be right, but that's the way I see it, and anyone who listens to me ever will know that that's me unfiltered and unedited.
Fabulous that we can do this again. Love to have you in studio again for the next big card or postcard. Really appreciate your friendship. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a deal.
You got
it. Thank you, JT.
You got it. Larry Pepe joining us, MMA Insider. Very critical look. Very critical look at the sport going forward. That is the type of radio I love. Non-vanilla, not on offense, a guy who had strong, strong opinions. Adam, you're on Fox Sports Radio. Thanks for waiting through that.
Hey, JT, how you doing?
Good.
I think that the U.S. national team part of the issue is the association that runs it. They care about selling jerseys rather than developing players. By keeping players like Clint Dempsey and players that are past their prime and keeping them on the field instead of letting the young kids come up and play and develop them. If you watch other nations, you know, their older great players, once it's time to go, they let them go. They don't wait. And then those players wind up here in the MLS.
Well, it seems like also seems like our young players, thanks for the phone call, our young players, you're right, aren't ready yet, so they're held back. And you're right, the stars that can sell the sport by keeping Clint Dempsey or Landon Donovan or some of the older players around maybe a year or two longer, it's because they sell tickets, they get fans interested, it's a familiar face or two, someone like a Michael Bradley that we want to keep around because we're comfortable with that type of player. But you're right. I just don't think we have the depth of the program of great players. My big issue when it comes to developing the U.S. men's national team here in the United States of America is how do we train them here without exporting them overseas? And to me, we have the money to do it. We just choose not to. And then there's the big conversation, which is fair, is that young kids after 15, 16 don't want to play soccer anymore because unless they're going to college, they don't think they can make enough money going pro. You know, if you got a full ride and you're going to Indiana or North Carolina, you could also be a doctor. You know what I mean? You might not think you're good enough to play overseas, so you bail on soccer and you don't play and push through. I don't have the answers here. That's why I always open up the phones to the people who know more. And for the soccer fans in this community here, I just pointed out Captain Obvious to you today. Croatia, with 4 million people, are in the World Cup final. Not the World Cup. We didn't even make it to the World Cup. They got to the final. We should be better than Croatia. I don't think I'm out on a limb saying that. Remember the Henderson Hyundai Superstore right there on Boulder Highway in Henderson? Unbelievable deals. I'll be down on the showroom floor next week talking about the new inventory, everything that's coming in, and why there's so much value. If you're looking for a new vehicle or pre-owned, you'll get a better deal there courtesy of this show and all the deals they're doing in town. The Henderson Hyundai Superstore, Boulder Highway. That value is real, and it's big, it's sincere, and we appreciate him supporting the show. Laker Talk next.
I was supposed to be there at 9:01, so I got there at 8:01. And so I was going to sit out there for an hour until it was my time to go up to his home.
That's Magic Johnson on the recruitment process of LeBron James. I can't believe I'm sitting here saying LeBron James is a Laker. JT the Brick Show, back with you on Fox Sports Radio. It's always special to me when I can put a friend on the radio show. And Alan Eisenstock has had a big impact on my life. We wrote the book together, The Handoff, which chronicled a big journey in my life when my mentor was diagnosed with terminal cancer and he picked me to be his chemo partner. And Alan saw the opportunity in that book, and we went together and we put out what I'm most proud of in my career, even more so than the radio show, The Handoff. And Alan was the guy who got the project off the ground and got it moving, and I can never thank him enough. But I can put him on the radio today because he has another brilliant book out, Hang Time, My Life in Basketball, Elgin Baylor, written by Alan Eisenstock. My good friend, good to have you on the show. How you been?
I'm great. How are you, JT? It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely my pleasure. And I know this is such a big book with all the books that you've written and all the success you've had. Let's talk about Elgin first and the early years. Talk about how he was a playground legend early on in his life and he found a love of basketball.
Yeah, and you know, no one had ever seen anything like Elgin Baylor. You know, the game at the time was kind of this, you know, this methodical, horizontal game. And what Elgin did was he made it vertical. He brought it literally to a height no one had ever seen before. I think it started on the playgrounds because he went up against his bigger, older, brawling brothers who were both kind of 6'8 and 6'7. And to compete with them, he had to figure out a way to kind of get around them. And so he did these acrobatic shots. No one had ever really seen them before. The other thing that he did on the playground was, at the time, you know, the outside shot was a two-handed set shot. You know, players kind of stopped, and then they launched this shot from their chest. Elgin tried that and was very uncomfortable, so he actually, he didn't start the jump shot, but he certainly refined it and developed it. So he actually found that he had more control by jumping and shooting at the same time. So, yeah, I mean, I believe that Elgin Baylor changed the game of basketball more so than maybe any other player.
Allen Eisenstock is our guest. Let's talk about early on in his life and the difficulties, what were happening in society, racially, some of the issues that he had to deal with. What did he first see as a young boy? The hardships of being a young African-American. He's playing basketball. People are discovering his talents. And then he has to make a decision that brings him to the military, basketball. Let's talk about that stage in his early youth.
Well, you know, actually, even way before that, people don't even realize what it was like growing up at that time, because there were two parks right next to his home where he lived. One was for whites only, the other was for blacks only. And the white park had everything. It had swings, it had the basketball hoop, it had a swimming pool. You know, the black park had nothing. It had, you know, grass. So in order for him to play basketball, he had to sneak onto the white court and play basketball before he got kicked out. But as time went on, he kept bumping into racism all the time. There's one really dramatic, emotional incident early on in the book that has to do with his sister, whom he loved dearly, Columbia, and his father had two Washington, D.C. cops came to the house, and they ordered the father to beat his sister in front of Elgin, and that left a lasting impact on his life. And then later on, what you may be referring to, JT, also is this was a different era in the NBA. When Elgin started, there were only eight teams. They used to play double headers. You would go to Madison Square Garden, there'd be one game that would feature, let's say, the Minneapolis Lakers, which is where Elgin started, against, say, the Syracuse Nationals, and then the Knicks would play maybe the Cincinnati Royals or something. So they were always looking for other places to draw crowds. One of the players on the Lakers was a guy named Hot Rod Hundley, who was from West Virginia. And he was lobbying for a long time to get Elgin to play in his hometown of Charleston, West Virginia. Well, they got a game. They were going to play against the Syracuse Nationals. And when they got there, the hotel manager told Elgin and the other two black players on the team that they weren't allowed to stay there. So the coach of the Lakers said, listen, if we're all staying together as a team, we're not going to separate the team. They ultimately went out, stayed at some kind of small motel, a roadhouse someplace, and the next day, Elgin refused to play. He wouldn't play. That was his protest. He wasn't, you know, loud about it. He was a very modest guy, but he was, you know, in his own soft, powerful kind of way, he just told Hot Rod, I'm not going to play.
Allen Eisenstock is our guest. The book is Hang Time, My Life in Basketball. About Elgin Baylor, it is phenomenal. It's an unbelievable book. I want to jump around here a bit, but stay in some type of order here. If you can tell us about his stint in the U.S. Army, where he played games on weekend passes. I think this is an unbelievable aspect of his life that most of our listeners don't know anything about.
Yeah, it was an incredible thing. I mean, at the time, Elvis Presley had got drafted into the Army, and the owner of the Lakers, Bob Short, told Elgin, he said, you know, you're going to be next, so you ought to, you know, you ought to enlist. So he did. He enlisted in the reserves, which meant that he had to do 6 months of active duty. Well, it fell during the season. So they stationed him at a base in, it was Fort Lewis in Washington. And he had to get this special kind of ruling from the league and the coaches that would allow him to play sometimes on weekends. So he would actually go to the base, and by the way, I don't know what they expected, but when Elgin got there, they didn't have a uniform that fit him. So, and they didn't have a cot that fit him. They had to put two cots together. He had no uniform, so he wouldn't wear a uniform. And then finally, when he did go for active duty, he did get a uniform. And so he would leave the base in Washington on a Friday, fly usually to L.A. at the time to play, and then go back because he had to be back by, I think, Sunday at 6.
Wow.
So, and what's amazing about that is during that season, he went back and forth, didn't practice. All he did was average 38 points and 19 rebounds a game.
We're talking about Elgin Baylor's career. The book is Hang Time, My Life in Basketball, authored by Alan Eisenstock, one of my great friends. He co-authored my book, The Handoff, which had a big impact on my life and going forward. An NBA champion in 1972, an 11-time All-Star, a 10-time NBA first-team player. He was the Rookie of the Year. He's considered one of the greatest players of all time. Why was it so difficult for him to win more championships with the Lakers?
Well, you know, actually, I'll say that he really never won a championship with the Lakers, technically, because in that 1972 season, he retired 7 games into the season. You know, Elgin's curse was bad timing, I guess, because that was the year that the Lakers won 33 straight games and finally did win the championship. But Elgin, although he was on the team, was kind of an honorary championship. So he really never did win a championship. He lost to the Boston Celtics. The Lakers lost to the Boston Celtics 7 times.
Oh.
They were in the finals 7 times. And the book, kind of the main part of the book, ends in 1969, where that was sort of Elgin's final. He kind of thought they had it. They had Wilt Chamberlain on the team. And that was the thing for Elgin. He thought they never could match up with Russell, and they couldn't. When they got Wilt, he thought, well, maybe this will be it. This will be the year. They had the series tied 3-3. It was here in L.A. They had balloons in the rafters. They were ready to go. They thought that the Lakers had the better team, and maybe they did. But starting the fourth quarter of that game, they were down 16 points. And ultimately, they ended up closing it to 1 point. And it's a famous shot, a famous sequence in which Keith Erickson knocks the ball away from Havlicek. The ball rolls to Don Nelson at the free throw line, and he puts up this shot put of a shot that bangs off the back rim, goes up like 3 feet in the air, and then falls through to give the Celtics a 3-point lead, and they never could catch him. So, you know, Elgin never won a championship, as far as I'm concerned and as far as he's concerned.
Wrapping up with Alan Eisenstock, for those listeners out there that remember him as an executive for the Clippers under Donald Sterling, can you talk about that and what was that all about for him, understanding the complexities and what turned out to be a bad guy in Donald Sterling and how he was able to handle that relationship, manage a team, bring in players, and keep those type of relationships going?
It was really tough for Elgin, I think, because, you know, Sterling had a reputation of being, I guess, not, maybe not at first, but I think it was always underlying that he was a racist. And secondly, he was incredibly cheap. Elgin, as a general manager, would get calls from coaches and managers and agents saying, you can draft my player, but he's not going to play for Donald Sterling. And it was such a difficult time, but Elgin really didn't see a way out. He knew that, you know, the longer he stayed as the general manager of the Clippers, which was 22 years, the sort of, you know, the deeper he got entrenched in it. And the sad part about that, I think, is that it obscured his greatness as a player. So many people, you know, they just think of Elgin as this manager, general manager, who maybe didn't do as well as the other general managers in the league, certainly not as well as Jerry West across town. But one of the reasons I really wanted to do this book, JT, was because I wanted to really write about Elgin the player and give him a due that he had not been given before.
Alan, finally, my dad, who just turned 80, said that Elgin was the greatest player that he's ever seen. And he saw Wilt Chamberlain, and my dad saw Bill Russell. And he saw all those players in that era, especially the great Knick teams that were happening. And he said he was Michael Jordan before Michael Jordan, Kobe before Kobe, LeBron before LeBron. And I really believe that. And we don't get a chance to see the video today. We don't see the YouTube videos. If we can end our conversation, compare him to maybe an athlete today, and what's the hook to the book on Elgin as a player, where youngsters driving around with their parents today in the car would say, wow, I want to go back and learn more about him. He was blank type of player.
Elgin Baylor, statistically, you know, we can start with that, actually had better statistics than Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
I pulled them up. You know, Elgin's, Michael Jordan's best year was, you know, he scored 37 points a game, 5 rebounds, 4 assists. Then he had 35 points, 5 rebounds, 6 assists. Elgin Baylor, 38 points, 19 rebounds, 5 assists. 35 points, 20 rebounds, 5 assists. When Michael Jordan was leading the league in, you know, minutes played, 40 a game, Elgin was playing 44 minutes a game, 42 minutes a game. So statistically, you know, I can't believe that Michael Jordan is always listed as the number one player, and Elgin sort of doesn't even make the list.
Yeah, incredible to me. And same with, you know, we have that conversation on radio all the time about Kareem and some of the players that are getting passed by. It's hard to forget Kareem, but Elgin Baylor, this book, I know it's just something that means so much to you. You were able to pull it off. We can send everybody, I'm assuming, to all major bookstores and Amazon.com, right?
Correct. That would be great, and yeah. Available everywhere.
I'm proud that we're friends. I'm proud of the fact that you've come into my life and we remain such good friends, and fabulous job with this book. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Same here, JT, and thanks so much.
You got it. Alan Eisenstock. I hope you enjoyed part of that conversation, all of the conversation on this book and the impact that Elgin Baylor had on the NBA. I think he summed it up beautifully with the stats. He might have been the greatest statistical player behind Wilt Chamberlain to ever play the game, and he wasn't Wilt Chamberlain. You know, he wasn't a guy who played center and was able to dunk and just go over the top of people and dominate that way. He came up with the first free-flowing jump shot, the first really fast two-way player that played both ways. And a lot of people remember him from working for Donald Sterling and getting beat up by what turned out to be a racist, and how Elgin had to put up with that to keep his job, to keep his legacy in the NBA, because people didn't follow him the way they should have as a player. They knew him only as an executive, and Elgin had to go out there and make a living. Really fascinating read. The book is Hang Time, My Life in Basketball, Elgin Baylor, written by Alan Eisenstock. Great that we can catch up with him. Feels like a podcast today. Two long-form interviews with guys who have really strong opinions. I appreciate that. When we come back, we'll set the stage for tonight with Looney. We got a good show lined up for you here at the top of the hour. Next 2 days, I'll be down at NBA Summer League. Excited about that. And tomorrow, I'm at Veterans Village downtown at 11 a.m. as the Raiders are going to present the Veterans Village with a $150,000 check tomorrow. How big is that? Raider Nation, unite.
Second serve. Onto the backhand of Georgia. Deep ball. Big off forehand from Williams. Now playing the backhand to the forehand of Georgia. Into the nets! And she gets a step closer to history. Her 11th time into the semi-finals of the championships. She did it in three. The 25th seed is through. 3-6, 6-3, 6-4. She salutes the crowds. A good performance from Camilla Giorgi. But in the end, just the force of Serena Williams running over the top.
I like that, Bobby. A British guy with some Serena, with some Guns N' Roses in the background. I like music. I like Serena. And this could be, I'm not positive here, this could be one of the top sports stories of all time, not this year. Serena coming off, giving birth, having a baby, and then coming back and potentially winning Wimbledon would make her the greatest tennis player of all time. I don't think we should be talking about men's and women's anymore and breaking it up. Roger Federer lost today 239 times. He's had a two-set lead. He's lost three times. And today was the day. He had match point in the third set to win the match, and he lost. An incredible moment. As Anderson came back to stun Federer, Nadal wins. He moves on. Djokovic is still alive. But again, tennis, another sport that's getting kicked to the curb by LeBron, and the world of LeBron that we live in. Think about this today. The biggest sporting event in the world happened, the World Cup. Serena winning, I think, is pretty big than LeBron not bouncing a basketball and playing a game. But people are talking more about LeBron not showing up to a pizza party in Culver City because he claimed on Twitter he might show up at a pizza party. He didn't. 1,000 people showed up. Imagine being a grown man and trying. I could see if you're coming with your kids. Right? You go with your kids. I got kids. If my kids said, hey, Dad, I want to go to Culver City, if I lived in L.A. to see LeBron, I'd say get in the car. I'd do it. But what if you're a grown man in your 40s or 50s by yourself and you just show up because you think LeBron's going to be there just for an autograph to try to sell it somewhere? There's chaos going on in L.A. because LeBron hasn't even played yet, hasn't even taken a picture in a Laker jersey. He tweets out that he might show up at a pizza joint that he's part owner of, and the world in Los Angeles goes crazy and no one talks about Croatia or Serena or Federer losing. You see, ladies and gentlemen, we're getting to the point now where everything is shrinking. Everything's shrinking in sports. And that's why we're lucky to have the Vegas Golden Knights. Because hockey, and I'm an expert on this, hockey was dead, done, dead on radio. You couldn't buy a tweet, phone call in any market other than Canada and maybe Detroit. Now that we have a hockey team in here in this town, we have all this content. We have a team that went to the Stanley Cup Final. We have a team now that looks like they're going to build to go to the Stanley Cup Final again in the future, maybe next year. It's going to be really compelling for us to talk about it, considering it was a sport that people were distancing themselves from. Obviously, we'll have a lot of NFL talk coming here in the next couple of years. I mentioned tomorrow, Veterans Village. The Raiders are coming to town tomorrow. A lot of the brass is flying in tonight for this big event at Veterans Village in downtown. A lot of media is going to be there as the Raiders are making a donation. And I think everybody's going to be really impressed to see what the Davis family, when Al Davis was alive and now Mark Davis, who's the owner of the team, the commitment that they do have to the military, and Vegas is a military town, what they did on that draft day three out at Nellis was exceptional. And the commitment that they'll be making tomorrow to Veterans Village is really a way for the Raiders to get into the community and to show everybody what they want to do long term and to build this brand and to build this passionate fan base locally in Las Vegas, because they have that global brand before they get here. Thanks to Bobby, who put the show together as always, and we appreciate our great friends at Golden Entertainment. Head on out to a PT's, close to 60 locations. We got a grand opening to talk about later in the week. We'll tell you all about that. The best happy hour in town from 5 to 7. And from midnight to 2 a.m., if you love sports, you love PT's, all the servers, everybody behind the scenes, their DNA is in sports and great service. Thanks to PT's. Looney joins me at the top of the hour. Evan Rosenblum from TMZ, the latest update, and TMZ has more information than any website or any group out there on what's happening with LeSean McCoy as of tonight. Thanks again to Bobby and everybody at Lotus. We'll see you from NBA Summer League Thursday and Friday.